Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to True Crimes Podcast. Today is Sunday, August 16th, 2015, and today I'll be talking to Lisa Wilson and Nick Vanderleek about their new book on Jodi Arias called Obscurity. And they've been on the show before. Here we go. Lisa Wilson is also known as Juror 13. She's a trial blogger who resides in California. She calls herself Juror 13 because she views cases from the perspective of a juror. And Nick Vanderleek is author of an 8-part true crime series on Oscar Pistorius and co-author of a series of books on Jodi Arias. Hi, Nick. And he's a freelance...
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So, how is it... You're in the middle of winter down in South Africa, right? Is it cold there? Can you hear me?
It's been really cold. The last few days have actually been pretty good. But yeah, I've been to Durban, which is like South Africa. Durban subtropical. So it's really odd. But Lisa can see me now. I'm wearing a beanie. I'm wearing like a sort of quite a padded, sort of warm top. Once I was going to the cinema in shorts, shirt that I was from in the sea and was also a little bit wet. So it's kind of crazy how, you can have it. I guess he says the same thing in California to some extent.
It is, yeah, no. Nick looks like he's about to go skiing right now. Meanwhile, it's like 90 degrees here in California, but we just have to drive 2 hours into the mountains and, not right now, but I mean, it's not unusual to have snow-covered mountains and a beach 2 hours away out here as well, so...
Wow, that sounds great. Yeah, it's about 93 here in New York. Okay, so Obscurity. Obscurity. This is your sixth book, right, on Jodi Arias?
It is the sixth and final book. Excuse me. And, one thing to mention, though, is these books are not necessarily, they don't have to be read in order. They are fairly interchangeable. So if somebody wanted to read them out of order, they could, and I think they would still enjoy them. But, yes, this was the final book.
Okay.
So
and the other books?
Authenticity and mendacity are the best two books to start with. But, as Lisa says, you don't really have to read them in order. But I do think... If you know nothing about Jodi Arias, I think Audacity is a great book to start with, and then Mendacity after it, and then from there you can go your own way. Yeah.
Okay, so start with Audacity and Mendacity, and then from there on, just whatever order you want to go in.
Yeah,
the first
two books go quite a bit into trial information, so if somebody wants just the background facts of the case, they'll get that from the first two.
Okay, great. Okay, so now...
Have you read Obscurity?
Say that again?
Liz, have you had a chance to read Obscurity yet?
Yes, I did. And it's very interesting. I didn't know learned a lot about her and her relationships and this whole... but I wanted to ask you, you were writing in the book about the similarities you found... between Jodi Arias and the men she dated. Do you want to touch on a couple of those, what you noticed in your research?
I'll take this one. So in several of the books, in particular Vanity, as well as the last two, Obscenity and Obscurity, we do focus quite a bit on both Jodi and Travis in their personal lives and their relationship together, their relationship with other people, and looking for patterns of how these people ended up the way that they did. And we definitely found some troubling things along the way. To answer your specific question about, you know, some similarities, when you look back at Jodi's background, her dating background, it's pretty interesting. The majority of the guys that she dated did cheat on her, with the exception of Daryl. I think everybody cheated on her. And yet, instead of her walking away from those relationships, she would become obsessed. Like, she couldn't let them go. And so, you know, we named this book Obscurity for a couple of different reasons. I think originally the title came about because here we are at the end of the series, and Jodi's now in prison, about to spend her life there, and in a sense going off into obscurity. And then, you know, shining that light back on ourselves and trying not to be obscure in our own lives, like, where do we feel insignificant? And, you know, we really figured out of everything that was going on between Jodi and Travis, the biggest problem that Jodi had, and actually which Travis had too, was each of them felt incredibly insignificant in their lives. And so they looked for other people and other things to try to fill those spaces for themselves. So, you know, when you look back at...
If I can just jump in there real quick. You know, what me really strongly in this narrative was, in terms of this whole struggle for significance, was the moment that Jodi met Travis. It was like this red carpet was rolled out for her in her mind, you know, going into the future, where she didn't just meet Trump or sort of in a sort of ordinary scenario. She meets him at this executive dinner, and there's this tremendous tremendously portentous, you know, what can possibly happen to her in her whole life. So in that moment, I think there's like fireworks going on in her mind, where she's thinking, this guy's my ticket to a better life, you know, like completely a better life in every single way, you know. You know, she needs to jump a few hurdles on the way there. One of them is becoming a Mormon. Another one is, you know, being the kind of girlfriend that he wants and all those kind of things. And, you know, she's desperate for this ticket, and she's desperate to please Travis in any way that she can. And, of course, she's trying to find any way that she can to hold on to that. And you can just imagine at the end of the story where Travis is about to go to Cancun, and Jodi was originally going to go with on that trip, and then she kind of gets let out the back door and, you know, just sort of go back to not Cancun. It is basically living in a small little room, like kind of a small dark, almost a room for a child in a grandfather's house in Wairika. And that is this insignificance that she's going to kicking and screaming. And I think we all know, it feels like we've all been in that situation where something ends, a job ends, a relationship ends, something ends, and you realize you're going to have to give up your car, you're going to have to give up a lifestyle. And nobody wants to do that, and especially when it's attached to a person. You're going to do everything you possibly can to, and I think for Lisa and I was finding that thing which is not unique to Jodi. I think we've all felt that desperation that you want to hit your wagon to someone who's going to show you the world.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people have asked over time, you know, why is it that she, like, flipped the switch with Travis? You know, I think a lot of people were confused by, you know, how did she have all these other relationships and then all of a sudden, you know, freaked out on Travis? And actually, if you understand those relationships, you see how that happens. I mean, Nick definitely mentioned it there when he said, you know, Travis had the most to offer her. That was the most that Jodi ever could see for her future. And, you know, she was just obsessed with having it. Whereas, you know, the other guys didn't quite have as much to offer, and you do kind of see this natural progression in her. Like, she kind of one-ups her game every time that she dates a new guy. Everybody has a little bit something, you know, to offer. What I thought was interesting, actually, about her relationship with Daryl, which was the last relationship before she got with Travis, and she was with Daryl for, like, 4 years, I think that was probably her most normal and stable relationship. And you know why? Daryl was absolutely head over heels in love with her. He didn't cheat on her. He was just completely in, you know, full adoration of her. And so she didn't have to fight anything. You know, I mean, there wasn't anything there for her to be obsessed about. She got what she wanted. And then when she was ready to leave, she just left. But with the other guys, with Bobby and with Matt, you know, when they started seeing other girls, she just absolutely flipped out because it wasn't about her, you know, like all of a sudden she wasn't the center of their world. So,
you know, which is interesting, all the narrative, each of them came from a different theme of audacity. You take the theme of men destiny, which is lying, you take the theme of vanity and obscenity. Each one is sort of shining a light from a different angle at this monster, which you can't quite make out, you know. Mm. Who is Jodie Harrison? You know, she keeps changing who she is, you know, like a chameleon, and you shine a light there, and the skin changes, and it's kind of like this weird thing, and you're trying to get a fix on this person, and they keep changing. And, you know, what's really interesting with the light that obscurity shone was this idea of Jodie, you know, at the end of the day, I think she knew what was happening with Trevor. She knew it was over. But by then, she felt like her entire identity was being lost. She felt like her entire, obviously not her life, not her profession, but that life, but her persona, this persona that she built up, all of that is going to be flushed down the toilet. And somehow she found a way to blame Trevor for that, to say that, Travis, it's your fault that I'm going to be a nobody and whatever. You know, I'm not going to swear, but you want to use the F word here. F, you know, psychology, is basically that she felt in order to wrest her life back for herself, she had to kill him. It must have been like a fantasy for her where she had this little daydream where she's going to hire a car, she's going to drive all the way down there, kill him and get away with it, and that way she's going to get the better of him and in a symbolic sense, kind of get her life back and have her life, you know. Because I think in a real way, she saw, in the same way that she saw Travis as a ticket out of obscurity, as a ticket out of insignificance, as a ticket to where she wanted to go, she also blamed Travis for not taking her there. So he was just as much her savior as he was her, you know, the end of her world. And so she wanted to control the end of her world, and by her killing him, not just killing him, but completely controlling his death, hurting him, it was her way of getting over him, literally getting over him, getting on top of him, and kind of almost like jumping off his death back into her life and saying, you're not going to get me down. And it's just a fascinating thing how that, through obscurity, the madness of that psychology actually made a lot of sense. That's actually what motivated her. And essentially just one upmanship. You know, I'm going to get you in order to get what I need for me. You know?
Right. And she did get, from killing him, like you said, she got so much attention in the press, the trial.
Mm-hmm.
That,
and she loved it. I mean, she absolutely ate it up. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about is how she, the person who she is today is kind of like really who Jodie is. Like, she kind of became who she was meant to be through this whole process. And she, I mean, I think Nick and I both agree that, like, the person she is today is actually even worse than the person that killed Travis. I mean, I think it's been this, like, progression into this absolutely, you know, despicable person. But with, you know, what I found really fascinating through the course of writing these books was that, you know, when I originally came into watching this trial a few years ago and just, you know, heard like the basics of the case and watched the first trial, you know, I was a little bit like other people, like, oh, Jodie, she's terrible, she's evil, she's this, that, whatever. And that was it, you know, right? Very simple story, crazy woman kills a guy, there you go. But when you actually take the time to get to know, like, somebody's life and their backstory and try to understand not just them, but their victim and their surroundings and all of that, you actually start to understand how people become what they become. And the very scary reality is, and I think this is exactly why people don't want to take the time to look at it, is because every single one of us as human beings actually has the ability to go down that route. And it's terrifying. But if you're not in control of your life, if you are lying and you are practicing things like The Secret, where you're just sitting around wishing things away, when you know, when you're insincere, when you become obsessive, I mean, people can turn into...
You're not responsible for anything.
Yeah. You, it happens. I mean, we know Jody because of this, you know, sensational trial. There's a lot of Jodys out there, you know, and that's a pretty scary thought.
Yeah, talk about this. You know, I was a little familiar with the law of attraction, but I didn't realize it was such a big thing out there, I guess, in the Mormon community and with Jody and Travis. How did she sit around doing nothing? Like, did she, like, what are some examples of what she was doing, living by this law of attraction?
Well, she, I'll start and then Nick, feel free to jump in. You know, Jody started to practice it prior to meeting Travis when she was with Daryl. And Daryl describes in one of the interviews that he does that she started to develop what he called magical thinking. He's exactly right. That's what it is. It's magical thinking. And Travis, through not just through the Mormon Church, but actually through PPL.
Can I just jump in there quickly? The almost idea of that magical thinking is like abracadabra, you say something, and then it just manifests in reality, which just makes life really, really easy. You say, well, I want a new car, I want a job, and then it just happens. You must just wait. All you need to know is to say it, and then, and this is really important. Don't say anything negative, right?
Yeah.
And anyway, Lisa, you carry on.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a really important point, because Jody used that to her advantage in the trial, which was pretty damn sneaky, but she, you know, her diary was half real, half fake. She did actually tailor her diary quite a bit. And she claimed, because now there were things that she was asserting about Travis during trial, you know, claiming that he beat her and he did all sorts of stuff to her. But yet when you looked at her diary on those days that she claimed it happened, you know, it was like everything was fine. Her excuse was that, oh, I couldn't talk about it because I couldn't be negative. So she kind of used it in a crafty little way to help her with her defense. But you know, to some extent, they did actually legitimately practice that. And you see it in Travis's diary, too. He'll be talking about something difficult he's going through, and then he'll end the sentence with, life is good, everything is great. And, you know,
in with that quickly, what you know, Liz, you may say, well, is it really, what's the secret really a big deal? Yeah, I think it was a huge deal. I think it was a huge deal with Travis and Jody. I think both of them had this mystical thing going on where they were practicing Mormonism, but they kind of thought the secret is to trump card. You know, this is really going to get them. But in other words, so both of them were looking for like a ticket to take them somewhere, someplace. But they weren't prepared to pay the price that everybody else pays, which is, you know, you need to study and get a degree and work hard and commit to certain things in order to get a certain result. And, you know, a lot of people think, I guess especially me, maybe not Lisa so much, is that I'm unfairly critical of Travis. But just look at this, for example. You know, everybody knows that Travis, there's a very deep desire of his to get married, to be married, right? And so Travis had these women that he was really, he kind of saw as like that could be an ideal wife. One, ironically enough, her name was Lisa. Another one was Mimi, for example. But as much as he adores them and loves them and kind of idolizes them and thinks they're ideal, he's not prepared to be the ideal man himself. He's not prepared to give up Jody, for starters. He's not prepared to be a sort of honest, you know, like how can I put it, you know, guy who's committed and dedicated and in a relationship with one person. And, you know, I don't know what the undercurrent was with his relationship with Mimi, but I kind of got the feeling that she kind of got the vibe a little bit that, well, this guy, this, you know, like Mimi would have been like, you know, for example, we're going to have sex when we get married. And whereas Travis has been having sex all along, you know, even as a Mormon. And maybe they're not used to that, whereas Travis is used to that. And he's not used to being with someone who's going to be like, why are you sort of putting your hands all over me kind of thing. I'm just saying this shows the sort of thing of, I want to be married, but I'm not going to pay the price to be with the kind of person that I need to be with. All I'm saying is that same kind of magical thinking of, I want something, but just because I want it, I deserve it, or I should have it, or whatever. And, you know, it's something which is kind of a little bit implicit in all of us. Is in our society, you know, we go to the supermarket and we buy things that we didn't grow. When something breaks, we throw it away and we buy something else. And a little bit of that magical thinking involved in that as well. We want something, we see an advert and we buy it. We forget that the underlying process is involved. And, you know, when it comes to consumption, we may not think it's a big deal, but then something happens to us. Like somebody dies, you know, someone that we were close to, or you know, a relationship doesn't work out or something like that. And then we don't understand it. And we feel like we didn't deserve it and we've got nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with us. When, of course, it is. And it's because of this disconnected sense of the secret thinking where if I think it, if I say it, that's all that's necessary. I don't need to do any work. I don't need to take any responsibility. And it's in this sense that Jody and Travis are wonderful people to look at, like almost in a fairy tale sense of how badly your life can go wrong when you make such a simple but profound mistake with your psychology towards yourself and towards others and towards life. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Now, I know that her past relationships, they meant her past boyfriends would say that she needed mental help, and her family said that she needed mental help. Did Travis as well feel that way about Jody?
Oh, yes. But, you know, she was...
Her mother said so.
Yeah, her mom did. When she was, when Jody was first arrested, there are some actually really interesting tapes you can find online of the interrogation, but there's an interview with the mom and the dad talking to Detective Flores, who's the lead investigator, and she, you know, the mother is kind of beside herself that her daughter was just arrested, and she can't understand, you know, what the hell, because Jody's been hanging out for the last week and a half, Travis has been killed, or 2 weeks, or whatever, acting like no big deal, you know what I mean? Like, she's been hanging out, and then when she does find out Travis is dead, she puts on a big old act, like, oh my God, what happened? You know, so they were, you know, really hoodwinked that their daughter killed him. Although I will say, I think that they weren't quite as hoodwinked as they acted. I think somehow they knew, you know, deep down. But she says to Detective Flores, you know, that Jody's friends used to call her and say she needs help. Like she's like they'd call the mother in the middle of the night and say your daughter needs help, and they never did anything about it. They didn't have a very close relationship, so.
You know, I think that the flip side of it is also very interesting. Is, you know, this whole idea of, you know, the secret where whatever you say is the truth and whatever, you know, in other words, there's no responsibility, there's no personal responsibility. And so when your daughter or your son is accused of this crime, well, somehow you find a way that you're not responsible. In fact, you know who is responsible? Victim. Travis's fault. Travis abused Jody, and so in a weird sense, even Jody's mother, maybe her sisters, I'm not quite sure of the extended family so much, but certainly her mother should feel guilt. Her mother should feel responsible, but she doesn't want to feel that. So how will she feel? I mean, you must remember Sandy Arias testified on Jody's behalf at sentencing, and you know, she was saying, well, you know what, we did the best we could, and it's kind of rationalizing the whole thing. It's kind of saying, Jody's actually, she was a sweet girl, and it's saying all the good stuff about it. None of it's really saying, you know, me as a mother, I should have known better. Me as a mother, I should have recognized the signals. I could have done this. I could have done this. It's none of that.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the message you get from Sandy Arias is along the lines of, well, you know, Travis didn't treat her very well, and so blah, 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 blah. In other words, it's actually not Jody's fault. It's also not the mother's fault.
Mm.
And you find it very interesting in a number of these cases where I think if it was most of us, we'd be like, you know, even if it was a family member, we'd be like, wow, you know, how could you do that? And, you know, how does that look to me, you know, being your relative? But the public response is, well, we're not responsible. And as soon as that's your response, you create a lot of problems, including for the perpetrator. In Jody's case, her mother supporting her. In Oscar's case, his brother supporting her, his sister supporting her, and his uncle, and everybody supporting him. Then can he really be that bad? And you can imagine if it's a situation where your family says to you, what you did was wrong, then you need to admit it and you need to say you're sorry. That's it.
Yeah.
But when they say, no, it's not your fault, it's the system and whatnot. So, yeah.
Well, it's not hard to see that. I mean, you see that in quite a few cases, these high-profile cases where the parents are supporting the kids. And you kind of get a sense of, yeah, like Casey Anthony, like Scott Peterson, you know, you get this sense of, you start to understand how these kids became adults and how they ended up, and I'm not saying that the parents are directly responsible, but they do have some culpability, and the more that you allow your kids to get away with that stuff and to make excuses, that's what happens. They become entitled, and they do whatever they feel that they can. So, and then I think that the parents do get to a point where they, for their own self-preservation and because of their own guilt, and they go along for the ride, and they, you know, and they sit there in court and they pretend like everything's fine and blame it on the victim.
Now, another thing I found interesting in Jodi Arias' case with, on the theme of obscurity, is that all of her family, nobody stood up and gave her a character reference. No one in her family, none of her ex-boyfriends. They all seem to want to stay out of the spotlight, right?
Yeah, she claims, now in an interview, Jodi claims that that was a defense tactic. That's completely untrue. I think that Jodi lied so much during trial that for any one of those people to get up on the stand and speak, they would have had to perjure themselves. And I don't think any of them were prepared to perjure themselves. You know, it was different when Sandy spoke during, hang on one sec, I'll let Nick, and Nick wants to answer this too. But, it was different when Sandy spoke at the very end of trial, because at that point, trial was over. It was just for sentencing. So Sandy can get up and say whatever the heck she wants. But when, at that stage during the first trial, anybody who got up and had to go along with Jody's story would have been telling a false story. And so I don't think anybody wanted to touch that with a 10-foot pole. That's what I thought. Go ahead, Nick.
Burnt a lot of bridges when she was a teenager and a young adult. I think she burnt a lot of bridges with her family, especially. I think she really wrote off her parents to such an extent that when she moved back to Wairika, she lived with her grandparents. You've got to ask yourself, what kind of person has this absolute desperate need to hitch their wagon to a boy or a girl? Now, what kind of person sort of, someone is essentially a stranger comes along, and you wanna hit your whole life to this stranger, and you are gambling that this stranger is going to ride you off into the sunset, take care of you, make all your dreams come true. But what kind of person sort of thinks like that? Well, someone who's already lost everything, someone who's got everything to gain because they've already lost everything. And so I think we need to remember that is that Jodi. I think Lisa will back me up on this. Jodi's relationship with her parents at the time of her arrest wasn't very good, and her mother was like, "Wow, I didn't really know what Jodi was doing." It was very patchy what was going on. In fact, I think Sandy said their relationship was almost the best it ever was in the week after the murder, where Jodi was just so sweet to her and all this kind of thing. But the point I'm going to make is just that. Jodi's obscurity was such that she'd burnt the bridges of so many relationships in terms of her family, and so she was really left high and dry. And so she needed some boy to save her. And this is where the secret's so damaging is, if you think, well, if I choose that boy, if I say I love him, if I say these words, he's gonna do what I need him to do. But what about anybody, any person taking personal responsibility and building your own life, saving your own soul, riding yourself into the sunset, making a life out of yourself. Jodi never made that decision, and it's just because of her psychology.
Mm-hmm. And maybe now that she's in prison, maybe she'll start doing that.
No.
No.
What would you do?
So, but you think, now you think she's gotten worse now that she's back into obscurity, that she's just going to get worse and worse?
Yeah, so real quickly, I know we don't have a lot of time, but you kind of mentioned, how much she enjoyed the press and everything that was going on after she was arrested, and she did. I mean, if you ever watched those interviews with her from, the point from the point that she was arrested all the way up through the very end of this last trial, she is just eating it up, because it's all about her, and she finally is significant. It doesn't matter what she's significant for. It just matters that people are talking about her, And so she has become, and we use this reference quite a bit. Nick came up with this, and I just think it's brilliant. She has become a fully formed chameleon. It's like she finally became the person that she never was. She's always going to be significant, and nobody's ever going to forget about Jodi Arias. It doesn't matter if she's in a prison for the rest of her life. We're all still going to be talking about her. So she won in her own sense.
Lisa and I, we're talking about, Jodi was saying, she wants to kill herself, she's suicidal and so on. And yet, we were talking about, is Jodi likely to commit suicide in jail? And both of us said, it's very unlikely because she's now who she wants to be. She's somebody, even if she's in jail. She's got some respect, I think, from the inmates and so on. And most important of all, she's got a fan club, which she never had before.
Mm-hmm.
Before, even while she was seeing Travis was probably her only fan and not someone who totally loved her, but he liked certain aspects of her. And now she's got a fan club. She never had that.
Yeah. Yeah, and she, the one thing that, and I think most people will agree with me, out of everything that Jodi's done post-murder, I will say the most heinous thing that I saw and was just absolutely appalled by was what she did to his family at the very end of the case when she got to speak, and she basically said to them, hey, guess what? I actually did, I do remember killing your brother, even though I lied in court. Well, I'm paraphrasing, but, she lied to the court and said she didn't, but she got up and said, hey,
Okay, well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but Obscurity by Lisa Wilson, Nick Vanderleek, available on Amazon. Thank you for being on True Crimes Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Bye. Take care.